got the Honourable Matondo here from Essex, the Parliamentary Committee. Is it Essex, Honourable Matondo?
Joint Essex.
Joint Essex. And I'm very pleased that he's able to join us for a short while before his own committee. We have here the apology, and that is Honourable Mabiyani, Mabiyani. Medical, Malkovich, he's there. Lo Tangini, he's there. Mm-hmm. Honourable Albert, party business coming late. Honourable Akashi, medical. As you know, we actually don't have any. So, we'd like to, on that note, it's going to be an hour, but not 2 hours. Anything after that will have to be conducted from my office, because we don't have a meeting. So can I have someone to propose the 1 hour agenda, please? Honourable Lorato seconded, Honourable Tirto seconded by the Honourable Pachai. We will immediately go on to the deliberations on the committee bill on debt relief. What does that mean? That actually means at this committee meeting, we ask the advocate Charmaine van der Merwe to take up through this, just the framework. So she will be doing that. That is all we are going to be doing. And as I said, the debt relief bill that everyone in Parliament has to be a serious consideration. Welcome to the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Matsudari. We've also got our tour, Mr. Nasibi Mishapa, the Company Secretary. We have from Justice and Correctional Services, we have Matapo MRM. And that is here from Justice and Correctional Services. I may add that we are very appreciative of that department and ministry for addressing a lot of the regulations that were hindering this particular process. And we need to thank you very much. And we've got Mr. Kumkani, the DTI, and I can't read this, but I can barely vote. Can we then, Advocate van der Merwe, we please ask you to continue. And we're very pleased you are here with us, because we know you have a short medical break. Thank you.
Good morning, members. I don't have a microphone, but I'll try and speak loud.
We need a
I'll use that one, and I hope that will be sufficient. If I am too soft, please tell me. It's a small room. And I am a lawyer after all. We know how to speak loudly. Basically, what I would like to address members on today is just applicable legal principles that we will have to consider for this debt relief bill. We've been focusing very much on what the problem is and possible ways of fixing that problem. But in any legislation, there are legal principles that we need to consider. And in fact, after I have considered these legal principles, I am asking you if the committee can give me a couple of guidelines, I should be able to bring you a bill that you can actually start pulling apart. Because it is much easier to start working on legislation if you have something in front of you that you can say, I don't like, than it is to say, this is what I want in it. That has just been our experience. It is much easier to see something as I don't, or this is missing, or so. So I hope that this will help you in that regard. The legal questions on this specific instance, when we look at debt relief measures, and in my view, if we look at the Insolvency Act, if we look at the Credit Act as it stands at the moment, these questions are all applicable to these pieces of legislation, because it is the same issue that comes up. And perhaps just to, because the members here also work on copyright, similar principles that I'm going to discuss today will apply to copyright. We might repeat it there, but it's just to let you know that these principles are, in fact, quite generally applicable. So what we need to answer in relation to debt relief specifically is we need to understand how our bill will impact on the Constitution. The first way that our bill will impact on the Constitution, or the only way that I can see that our bill will impact on the Constitution, is if debt constitutes property for purposes of Section 25. Section 25 deals with property, your right to not be deprived or expropriated. If we then answer that question affirmatively, say yes, it is property, then the question is, would any debt relief measure constitute either deprivation or expropriation? Because those two manners of affecting property have different solutions around them. And then thirdly, once we've identified how that right will be affected, what would be the constitutionally legal way of, in fact, affecting them? So those are the questions that I'll try to answer. Next slide. Yes. So the first question is whether debt is property. And I've been really struggling with this answer because there is not a specific case that tells us debt is property. We have case law that speaks about the fact that assets that are movable, in other words, not land, this bottle of water, your phone, or assets that you can't see, like shares in a company, like copyright itself, we have case law that says that constitutes property. But we do not have case law that specifically says debt constitutes property. So what we have is, I've mentioned the one case there, the National Credit Regulator versus Opperman, where the court said that we must not go too wide so that your regulation, your legislative regulation is actually impractical. But you can't be too narrow because this is protection in terms of the Constitution. There must be a reason why the Constitution wanted to protect property. And in fact, sorry, the Constitution itself says that property is not limited to land. So we know that the intention was to go broader. Now, I then found some international comparisons, and India, Australia, Germany, and the United States, all of those countries, when considered, courts indicated that for purposes of constitutional protection, or whether it's a constitution like ours or constitutional laws, like the United, I think the USA works on laws, then debt will be considered as property. So in my view, on the answer of whether, so you can't see, but at the top there, the question is debt property? And the answer at the bottom is, it is likely to be found to be property. So my advice would be that when we craft our bill, we need to take into account that there is a 99% chance that this will be regarded as debt, as property by a court. And that then brings us to the next question. If we accept that debt is property, and we base this on our international comparisons, at how our courts have so far been looking at debt, the relevant section, and I've quoted on your slide for you the two types of ways in which your right to property could be affected. Now, the way the Constitution words it is, of course, this may not happen. But it also means that this allows us and it gives us an indication of how it can happen. So if we talk about deprivation of property, that's the first one, and that is Section 25(1) of the Constitution. Then we need a law of general application, and that law of general application may not provide for arbitrary deprivation. I'll still speak about these terminologies. So I'll still explain it a bit more because it is a bit difficult. But for now, so we can just keep in mind, that is how one is dealt with. Two speaks about expropriation. So we have deprivation and expropriation. And unfortunately, in our society, when we talk about Section 25 of the Constitution, most people's minds immediately go to expropriation. Because it is so prevalent, that is what is talk of society. We talk about expropriation, but there are actually two types. One is deprivation, one is expropriation. Expropriation has a lot more before that can actually happen. It must be for a public purpose. It must be in the public interest. There must be a law of general application again, and there must be compensation. And if we then look at what the difference is and how our courts have interpreted which is which, the latest case that I could find is that is Agri SA versus Minister of Minerals and Energy. And what happened in this case is that the government became custodian of all the minerals in the country. And the court said that, or the argument was, the mines were saying, now we are expropriated because you have now taken this property, this mineral that we used to own, you now say it is in the state's custody. And the court actually said that, no, custody is not sufficient to constitute expropriation. For expropriation, there needs to be ownership by the state. So it's about, is there something that the state takes? Then it becomes expropriation. It doesn't mean that Section 25 is not affected, but it becomes 25.1, which is deprivation of property. So it is a bit of a technical, and I'm maybe not explaining it that well because it is quite difficult to grasp. So please excuse me, I'm just going to capture again what I've said. Section 25.1 deals with deprivation of property. There has to be no benefit for the state. That's irrelevant. It simply means that the person will make a sacrifice in respect of their property, and that is only allowed if it's a law of general application, and I'll tell you now what that is. That is not arbitrary. Expropriation, 25.2, is where the state gets a direct benefit, ownership, things like that, and in that case, the state is only allowed to do that expropriation if it is in the public interest, for a public purpose, and if there is compensation given. So those are the two big things. And in my view, if we look at debt relief, there is no ownership taken by the state. If we look at sequestration, for instance, the fact that the creditor no longer has a claim against this debtor, say for that 5 cents in the rand that the executor will be paying, it's not the state that benefits from that. Yes, there's a new push to the economy because you give this debtor a break. The same with debt review. You are saying to the debt, to the creditor, you can't immediately claim your money or you must bring your interest rate down to zero. But there's no benefit directly for the state. The state does not take ownership of that debt or that claim. So because of that, I'm of the view that it is deprivation. Now, if we look at deprivation... Did it go across? Yes, it went across. Sorry, five. So if we can look at deprivation, and let's now drill down into what this means. What is the law of general application? Because that is what our bill will have to comply with. And there's actually quite a lot that we will have to keep in mind. I'm not sure because, I'm not saying it tongue-in-cheek, but I'm not psychic. I'm not sure what everyone had a picture in their head of. But I almost certainly had this picture of a debt relief measure, almost like a check, you know. This is the measure, like something that you can put in a little box and say, this is what we're going to do, and that would be the end of it. But if I look at law of general application, it's not going to be that easy to just package it into a tiny little gift box, for instance, and we give that to the debtor. It won't happen like that. We won't be able to get away with that. Not because that will not constitute a law of general application. So what is a law of general application? The first thing that is very important to remember, and I got this from constitutional property law and also from constitutional law review. The first thing, if you say law of general application, people tend to think that, oh, it means it must be applicable to everyone. And in fact, there are court cases that say no, provincial legislation are still laws of general application. It is not about who it applies to. Law of general application talks about the rule of law. In other words, fairness, openness, transparency, not arbitrary. Because what is being protected here is something called law of attainder. And I actually had to go look it up because law of attainder, A-T-T-A-I-N-D-E-R. And I actually had to look the word up because it's not a word that I was familiar with. But that means the type of law where a person was found guilty, for instance, of treason or of some other capital crime, and a law was made to take the property of that person. Wasn't applicable to other people. That person that was found guilty, there would be a law to say, your property, so you were, for instance, Lord Mountbatten, and you owned some castle in wherever. And then the Westminster Parliament would make a law to say, Lord Mountbatten, your property is hereby forfeit to the state. That is the kind of thing that is being avoided here. Now, it sounds maybe then very clear-cut, but not 100%, because it's the law, and lawyers need to have work, so we like to make things complicated, and I do apologize for that. But for instance, Security of Tenure Act, there was a concern that because the Act only applied to agricultural property and not to residential property, that there was not an equal treatment of people who owned property. So it can be a little bit more than just one person. It can be if you single out a group of people. So we'll have to be very careful. But we do have guidelines. And the guidelines are that, one, the law must ensure equal treatment. Now, we need to keep in mind that we also have another case where the court very clearly said that, given South Africa's history, I don't have it up there, but if necessary, I can send the citation. It's President of the Republic of South Africa, in other words, it's Hugo. It was a 1997 case that dealt with the time when the president was giving pardons to certain prisoners, and he gave pardon to women who had children. And a man then came and said, ah, no, this is not fair. What? How can you? I also have a child. And the court actually found that, yes, it had to be extended to men as well. But in this case, the court made a very, very, very important statement, which reads, maybe it's a bit of a long sentence, but in I'll send the citation to Andre if anyone is interested. And it's in paragraph 41 of the case, the court kind of says that we need to develop a concept of what is unfair discrimination. Where are you treating people unequally? Because although we are living in a society where we have the right to equality, we also have a goal to make everyone equal, because we don't have that in practice. And because we don't have that in practice, because of our history, there might be one context where treating this group in a certain way may be fair, and another context where treating the same group might be unfair. So it is very much a case-by-case business, which of course makes our job much more difficult, because it means that we will have to be very careful in what we consider with our death relief. But if our act treats similarly situated persons alike, then we will be able to argue that our bill is in fact providing equal treatment. The second part of that equal treatment is simply that I think this is more the effect where the creditors as private creditors and creditors as state creditors must be treated the same. And I don't think that will be a problem. From what I've heard so far, I think there would definitely be equal treatment. In fact, the state might maybe be a little bit worse off in some instances. Especially if I think about like the municipalities that indigent, where already the municipalities is giving a certain free services and so on to indigent. So I'm not worried about that one. So what you will simply have to do is you'll have to make very clear that the group that we are affecting in this bill, all people that qualify on those basis are included. So it is simply going to have to be a little bit of deliberation. Perhaps we can get, I have definitely suggested that we will get, that the committee maybe obtains opinion from senior counsel. I also have come across some academics that are experts in property law, expropriation law, that can perhaps assist and just help us through this. But as I currently see it, this committee bill is addressing a gap. We have the insolvency law that speaks to people where there's benefit to creditors. We have debt review, who speaks to people where you can't really seek a straight, or you don't want to seek a straight. It's not really at that point in time. You could still be able to get out of this mess, but there's a cost involved. And these people, this group, can still pay that cost. And then you have this group that we are targeting, that we are saying cannot get debt relief, whether sequestration, debt review, because they cannot afford it. And I think that addressing that gap will put our bill to pass constitutional muster, and we will be able to pass that equal treatment requirement. The second aspect is that there must be a discernible standard. And in fact, I think I've already started speaking about the various things. So let me just maybe quickly run back forward to the next slide, slide six, because there's a little bit more flesh already. The discernible standard, what that means, and again, here I come back to what I said initially, that a law of general application is about openness, transparency, not being arbitrary. So when power is given to officials, and here we will be looking at the credit regulator, the tribunal, could be other parties as well, that power that they will execute has to be very, very clear, and clear criteria, clear standards for them to apply. Discretion should be limited to situations where this committee won't be able to foresee the exact situation. But the application, this is what must happen. So that your officials, when they exercise this, when they consider this debt relief measure, it must not be a situation where a person is able to say, you smiled very nicely this morning, I'll give you the debt relief measure. Or, no, you actually, I saw you when you came to park, you took my parking spot, so no, you're not getting the debt relief measure. I mean, it's not very basic, that example, but we need to avoid that kind of situation where a person can make a decision based on subjectivity. To do that, and there might be other ways of doing it, but I have thought, I've looked at the research that has been done, and the only way that I can propose for this committee that I can see would not be arbitrary. And in fact, even if we take away, if we imagine South Africa without a constitution, the debt relief measure, in order to test whether that is successful, you'll have to have records. So I cannot see us getting away without an application process. I cannot see us getting away without some investigation. It can't be an automatic application, in other words. There will have to be consideration of that application. We will have to give the creditor a chance to counter that application. And I understand that I'm adding red tape to this, and probably members are getting frustrated with me, but unfortunately, these are the legal principles that we will have to consider. We can perhaps see what we can do to ease those steps. But those are the kind of things that we will have to do. If I can give you one example, a debtor, let's say we say you must earn less than 3,000 Rand a month, and you will show us your salary slip to prove that. So a debtor comes to the credit regulator and says, here's my application, look at that, I only earn 2,000 Rand a month. Then we need to somehow, then if it's approved, the creditor might turn around and say, but wait a second, in order to qualify for this debt, this person told me that they are keeping three jobs, and here are the other salary slips. They actually earn 15,000 rand a month.
Uh-huh.
This 3,000 is their after-hours jobby. So, you see, there will have to be some interrogation, and we'll have to give the creditor an opportunity to counter. So, that will have to be done. And because there will have to be an investigation, for transparency's sake, you will have to have a separate body make that decision. Now, I've already thought about this, and I know that there's a lot of concern about having to go to the magistrate's court, the fact that it's expensive, et cetera, time, and so on. But there is a tribunal, and if we need to look at how we make it easier for the tribunal to deal with these kind of decisions, then that is what we need to do. And I'm not saying it must be the tribunal. I'm just saying that these are the bodies that are currently there. And if we say the investigation is done by the regulator, for transparency's sake, you can't be judge and the prosecutor in the same matter. So, and that would take away the arbitrary as well, because you have an independent, not independent, but a party separate from the person who investigated who makes the final decision. The other two are quite easy actually to deal with, precise and clear. We, in fact, already this committee has indicated that it is not satisfied with simply saying to the minister, go and make regulations to put a debt relief measure in there based on economic circumstances. This committee has already indicated that, no, we will have to give clear criteria. We will have to say to the minister, you need to come and consult us. You need to consult so-and-so and so-and-so, and et cetera. So I think that the committee is already on board with precise and clear. And then lastly, accessible, that is something that Parliament and the Constitutional Court will do for this committee, because the law will be published in order to be able to commence and become operational. Now, having given you that background, and I understand that it's maybe a lot of information that needs to be digested first, but there are a basic couple of principles that I've already set out. And if the committee says to me, yes, go write up for us an application process. Go write up how we are going to keep record of these people. Go write up that at this point in time, let's say the regulator will be doing the investigation, what will be happening there. Go write up for us that the tribunal will be making the decision, what will happen there. And when you look at the minister's regulations, go write up the criteria based on, of course, what has been discussed here, because I will not be able to think this up by myself. Looking at the stakeholders' input and so on, I should be able to give this committee a bill that, with all due respect, you can pull apart, because that is just how legislation works. And I don't feel very bad about saying to this committee, you are welcome to pull my bill apart, because normally, before one of our bills are introduced, we end up with three or four drafts, and sometimes they look very different, because the beauty of having a bill in front of you is that you can see the picture, and you can see that, no. Someone once said to me about drafting, it's very difficult to take over a draft from someone else, because the executive might have a giraffe in mind. Then you come to Parliament, and suddenly Parliament says, no, we want a hippo, and it's two very different animals. But the beauty is that you can see the giraffe, and you can see that, no, this thing is eating the top leaves. I want something that will go into the water. And then we can do that. So these are the kind of things that the current framework that I have presented to show the gaps does propose an application process. It proposes that the credit regulator will be investigating the application to make a recommendation to the tribunal. I've currently also, in the framework, provided for a number of possible orders that the tribunal could make based on the circumstances of the debtor and creditor in front of them. It might be that the debtor, for instance, says, I've just accepted a job, and I'm going to receive 4,000 or 5,000 rand a month, but I really need to just get out of this, and then I will be able to repay. In that case, the tribunal might say, well, then 12-month suspension is maybe more in order than a straight writing off of your debt. But this is not something that this committee can see beforehand. So that is where a type of discretion, I think, could come in handy. And then, of course, the committee, all those requirements that the committee set out before in relation to the discretion for the minister, the minister making regulations under strict conditions rather than an open discretion, those can be in there. So if I can do that bill, so if the committee says to me, fine, the framework that is out there, go and flesh it out for us. Do something that looks like a bill. Then these are the kind of things that we can add. We can pull the bill apart and change it and put extra stuff in, take stuff out, because the category of debtor qualifying is easy. That's going to be a definition or one clause in one of the clauses. If the application process is too long, too bureaucratic, we can take out steps, we can make it easier. The investigation, what must be looked at, all of these things can, in fact, then be done at a later stage. So already committee members can say, look, we understand that this is what we want. We've got the big policy direction. We want a debt relief measure. And if I then can have that buy-in from the committee, that is the product that I can give you. And these are the kind of things that can then be fleshed out at a later stage, and at least we start making progress in this matter. Thank you very much.
Did you say thank you?
Yes.
I'm not sure if you can hear me, but it's a small enough room. I just want to, on what has been said by the advocate, the chair of us, Advocate Vandeleuva, point out where we are with this bill and why we are doing this. You will recall we got to this point when we were in the old assembly, and there was some request that the bank should be here, etc., which, as we know from the timeline, the necessary people were consulted. Now, where we are now is we got the permission of the National Assembly to go ahead with a committee bill draft and a memorandum, and I'm going to not read it all out because time is against us, but I'm going to refer you to page 160 of the new rule book, 2741 ABC 2 and 3. And I'd like you, as part of where we get to tomorrow, everyone, to have read that and to have gone through this. So what we're going to ask now, because we're having deliberations tomorrow, as you know, all right, is clarification on what may have been said here. And to sustain our substantive deliberation for tomorrow, Thursday. So it's open to you, Honourable Williams, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Pacharya.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want some clarity on what you meant by this bill has to give the creditor the opportunity to challenge the application. And I want to know what legislation compels us to do that. Why do we have to do this? Because this bill is fundamentally there to benefit the poorest of the poor with their debt crisis that they're in, and now we're putting in roadblocks to stop them from accessing a tiny bit of credit, debt relief. So it's going to be this long process, and I know you're saying you can make it shorter, but I just want to know what compels us to give the creditor the chance to challenge the application for debt relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm just a bit concerned that we're having this discussion without the research that we had requested through the terms of reference. I thought that would, really be informing our discussions. So we actually know who are we talking about. Who are the people that would receive debt relief? Is it people that have debts with registered financial institutions? Is it people who have debts with illegal credit providers that actually, how do they prove that they actually have debt with them? And in that research, that was supposed to identify the groups of people we were referring to. And I'd be very hesitant for a bill to start being drawn up, even if it is so, in your words, Advocate, to be pulled apart, because you know, we're going to be pulling apart something that we don't know who it is meant for. So that is my first concern. The second thing is that I absolutely believe we need that senior counsel opinion. In fact, that's what I've been asking from since the very beginning. I've been asking National Treasury for that. So I would really like to see that before we consider anything, because I think that that's going to have profound and material effects on anything that is considered. The third thing is that you've highlighted a very important point, which I've also been making since the very beginning. A committee bill cannot be done without looking at other legislative changes that are going to be made. And I quite rightly agree with you, you know, that you would need someone to adjudicate that. Now, if that's going to be the NCR, I'm sure Ms. Moshagera is going to go into heart failure because it's going to overstretch her office. Now, who's going to fund that? Are there going to be legislative changes? Because if there are, and she and her office is going to adjudicate that, and I've also asked for this from the beginning, agreements should be suspended until that they are actually agreed to. But that's going to require legislative change. Now, as everybody knows, the NCT is overstretched, and that's putting it mildly. We wait years for cases to be adjudicated there. And we've also got some thoughts about, you know, legislative changes that need to take place for the NCT. So I'm still really concerned, and I'm a bit frustrated that I think we're trying to rush this thing for whatever reason that may be, instead of actually plotting this thing out, deciding what is it we want, who do we want to focus this towards, and what are the broader ramifications going to be that is based on the empirical research that we have asked for. We can't ask for something, ignore it, and then proceed on that basis.
Thank you,
Honourable McPherson. Honourable Pichani.
Thank you. I may be going on a bit of a tangent here, but an idea popped into my head which may be warrant consideration if we are going to pass constitutional muster in terms of the legality of all this. You raised the question of whether debt constitutes property and talked about deprivation and expropriation. I suggest that we also consider alienation of property. And in this regard, look at the recent Constitutional Court decision on which says that new purchases of property are not liable for historical debt. Now, in terms of that, I'm interested in the implications for us, because if that decision said that you cannot include the transmission or integration of historical debt into a tangible bundle of new assets, then what impact does this have on Section 25, and how do we pass constitutional muster on this one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to say, I think there's a lot of work that seems to be been done already on this. I unfortunately haven't bring my notes. But I still say that I think a wrong word to use in this is debt forgiveness. You know, if financial institutions are compelled by law or legislation to write off even small amounts, it would be very negative consequences for our economy. So debt forgiveness, I think, is the word that we must completely edit. Also, banks or financial institutions mustn't take advantage of debt relief and debt counseling by applying additional credit onto, you know, longer terms and take advantage of the poor in that way. The National Credit Act already makes amendment and already look after credit. To enforce law to banks, this would stop banks for make it very hard to give people loans and will force people to go to these, what do you call it, loan sharks and people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Esther Hazen. My comment here is rather than a clarification, I think this is very welcome to explain these issues because they've come up from the beginning and how do we deal with them, which is why I found the point you've just made, Honorable Pacharya, quite important. We never did take that into account and that's useful for us to look at. But what I would like to also remind members of is that when this came up, the decision that went to Parliament was basically to look at the most vulnerable. Subsequent to that, the subcommittee, not the committee, thought it may be quite opportune to actually look at other groupings, if I may put it that way. Not the most vulnerable per se, but other categories. And it was important that National Treasury should be part of that process and consult. You're looking at people earning an income, a daily income, a monthly income. So I think we should simply be mindful of that. But this meeting is intended to have got this legal report so that tomorrow when we absolutely engage on the matter, we have had an opportunity to study the document. So over to you to respond to the points already made, Advocate Fandemova.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Williams, for the creditor to get the opportunity to challenge the application, that is unfortunately one of the basic principles of fairness, openness, transparency. And it will be part of the requirement of not being arbitrary. Mm-hmm. Because if the application is submitted, like the example that I gave, if a person says, I earn 1,000 Rand a month, mm-hmm. And the credit regulator does an investigation, and it seems to them that this is what the person earns per month. But a creditor then comes to show, no, this person, this 1,000 Rand that they're earning is actually delivering pizzas after work. They actually have a day job, and in that day job, they earn 15,000 Rand a month. So that is the kind of thing that we need to address. Also, there might be other things that the creditor needs to bring to the attention of the person who makes the decision, because any decision that is made has to listen to both sides and understand the situation. Your creditor is already going to be on the back foot because there are going to be legislation that says if this is complied with, this debtor will be entitled to some relief of the debt that this debtor is under. But the creditor needs to be able to give some input. And there's a number of things that we can follow. I understand that the tribunal is overstretched. I understand the regulator is overstretched. We could look at total different bodies. This is really to put a bill before members that we can kind of start asking those questions. But aren't they overstretched? Should we not look at another body to do this? Because there are processes that we can follow. It could be something like a motion process that the High Court or Magistrate Court also does, where the application is in writing, the creditor's input is in writing, the tribunal or the body that makes the decision looks at two pieces of writing and makes a decision. And in that way, you can probably get, I know some motion courts get to through 300-400 motions on a day or 2 days when they sit for the week. It is quite possible to do that. We must also keep in mind that the grouping that we're targeting, from the stakeholders' feedback, there's already a voluntary process that these banks have with debtors that earn so little money, where they bring the interest down to zero, where they say, okay, this will be write off, it's whatever. So So there is a likelihood, and I'm not a statistician, but there is a likelihood that a number of these cases will be unopposed. The creditor will say, well, just give me that proof that this is written off so that I can put that in my books, because then there are at least some accountancy measures that happens for me. The other question, to go to Honourable McPherson, I hear the concern about the fact that there's still this research, we're still looking at things, but that is why I'm saying the framework that I put out there is very much based on the principles that I've presented today. And that's perhaps where a little bit of a disjuncture was as well, because the principle should maybe be presented first to explain why the framework looks like it does. There are things in that framework that I can do. It's very close to done in the sense of the legal side of things. There's consequential amendments that have to be made. The process might have to be fleshed out a little bit. But those are things that will be applicable whether our debtor earns 5,000 Rand, 7,000 Rand, 10,000 Rand, whether the debt owing is 2,000 Rand, 5,000 Rand, 10,000 Rand, because it does not matter whether the group is absolutely no assets, no income, or a little bit of assets or income. The legal principles remain the same for both of them, and we will have to have transparency through the process. So those are the kind of things that I can start doing, and if that assists this committee, then I'm happy to do that, because that is what my job is to assist this committee. The other thing about, the senior counsel. The big thing about senior counsel opinion, getting it at this point in time, is that depending on what our bill states, because I've now given the principles, but let's say we forget about one grouping that also qualifies for that criteria, then our bill will not pass constitutional muster. So senior counsel is going to be very important at the time when the bill is more or less in the format that this committee sees it going forward. There will still have to be public participation. That could change things. But I think that is the earliest that senior counsel could be asked for an opinion. Otherwise, your senior counsel is going to say, well, what I can give you is this kind of feedback. The general principles of law. I can't tell you whether your bill will actually be complying with the general principles of law, and I think that is really, really important to get. So make sure that the bill actually complies with those principles. Just on the one thing that you've mentioned, the illegal providers. One of the things in the framework currently is expressly excluding reckless lending and illegal debts from the debt relief measure, because there are measures for those already in existence, and that then needs to be followed, strengthened, if it's not strong enough to be strengthened. Changes. I've spoken about overstretched and so on. In respect of alienation of property and the recent decision, I'm trying to think of the name because I actually had to summarize it. Deprivation of property is the catch-all, and it deals with any way that property, your right to your property, is infringed. Whether it is delay of your right to execute on your property, you're not allowed to sell your shares now. You must wait for 5 years. That would be deprivation. I am taking property away from you, the alienation side, that would constitute deprivation. Expropriation is then a subset of that. So it just shows that deprivation is the umbrella, and then you get different types of deprivation under that. So I would be satisfied that alienation is in fact covered under deprivation. The issue of the court case, sorry, I cannot remember the name of the case now, but what happened there was something that the municipalities did. And in fact, the law was found constitutionally compliant, but the municipalities applied it unconstitutionally. So what municipalities did was, and I'm sorry, I think let me just give the background to that case, because it gives, yes, I'll send the details through as well. What happened was municipalities had the problem that monies owed to them, rates, electricity, water, etc., they would execute against immovable property. So they had a secured claim for that debt. But if the property is then sold, then they don't have, they must still go against the previous owner, and then there's no immovable property anymore. So what happened, and it actually started, I think it was in the 1800s, where there was, if I remember correctly, it's one of the provinces, it was the Transvaal Act, I think, Transvaal Proclamation, where they actually got a lien over the property. So the property sale was stopped until the money was paid. So it could not go further. Then that went further, and it developed a bit more, and there were more rights given to municipalities. And the court looked at the specific clause in the section in the Act and said, but the court could not see that there was ever an intention for this right of municipalities to be transferred to the new owner. That was never the history of the section. It is not clear from the section itself that the section allows for transfer of that right. And the court then said that the transfer of the debt to the new owner of the property, that is not even allowed by the statute. And because of that, the practice was stopped, and the court made the decision to say that you cannot transfer the debt of the one owner to the new owner with the property. So that was that. I think from Honourable Eerstein, it was more comment. I don't really think that there was a question as such, and the same from Honourable Fass. I don't think there was a specific question, that you, more comment. And then I think that's the answer. Thank you.
Well, the thing is that this was not intended as a deliberation. I'm sure you appreciate it. We specifically earmarked Thursday, that's tomorrow. So we certainly want to get the clarification on this, so that when we come tomorrow, we can really dig into it and put our proposal forward. Yes, Honourable McPherson?
Thank you, Advocate. I think by Honourable Williams's admission that the bill is intended to deal with the poorest of the poor, to use his words, I'm not sure how the framework is going to deal with that particular point, because in my mind, and from what I understand, that the poorest of the poor's debt is actually very, and I'm just sort of paraphrasing or using my own thoughts, is that their debt is not with the banks. Their debt is with illegal credit providers, people that have provided them with debt recklessly. And so I'm still trying to get to grasps with how this thing is being framed, because the potential for a bill to be written and to attempt to assist the poorest of the poor could completely miss its mark, because it's not actually speaking to the people that we have in mind. And that's why I think it's so critical, once again, that we understand what the research says to us. Does the research say that the poorest of the poor's debt is in fact with registered financial institutions, or is it with illegal financial institutions? Is it recklessly lent debt? Because then those are mechanisms that, as you quite rightly point out, are catered for in the NCA. Unfortunately, the NCA is not being used with the intended purposes that we gave it. And I say that because, Advocate, what I want to avoid is, much like Honourable Williams, we want to deal with this thing. We want to get on the ball. But if we don't do it with the facts in front of us, we're going to waste your time, our time, and we're going to have a copyright amendment bill situation where we're going to get so far down the track with a committee bill that, and then the research comes and goes, whoops, we completely missed the mark here, and then we're going to have to start all over it again. So I really think that those are important things to consider, Advocate, because I I'm going to repeat again that I think that a committee bill has to speak to a dual or tri-amendment process of amending the NCO amending the terms of the NCT, looking at how that's constituted. Because I think if we just look at a committee bill in isolation, Advocate, we're really going to run into trouble down the road. Sorry, Chair, and if I may, just one more point. And then also just, I share the Honourable Eerstehuizen's concerns about what this bill is titled. And I think that we use the words debt relief, debt forgiveness, extinguishing of debt very interchangeably, and they all quite frankly mean different things. And I'm not sure that we in our own minds have actually settled what is it that we want this bill to be called, because once it's the title will inform the preamble, which will inform the content of the bill. And I think that we need to settle on that. And I mean, I must be honest, I've been racking my brains over the last few weeks about what is the title of this bill meaning. And I don't have that yet, and I'm still trying to search for it. But I don't know if you have a legal term as to what it would be called that would inform the preamble, that would then form the content with what we're trying to achieve.
Area. And
we're doing that because now it cannot wait. And you made a reference, Honourable MacPherson, to the Copyright Bill, and it reminded me more than yesterday when we stood up with the moment of silence, thinking this photographer had come here seeking relief from a bill of ours, and he was dead before we passed that bill. Well, this is even more urgent. Let us address this issue while those who are alive and their families can benefit. That is what we took as a decision in the committee for this bill. We didn't take a broad, overarching position in the bill. So what I would like to implore members is that tomorrow, this Honourable MacPherson's points are valid. And I would like you, Advocate van der Merwe, because we do need to go now, that this room, even though the equipment is not working, is wanted. And I've said we're going to have to find another room tomorrow.
Yes.
That I would ask you to respond briefly now, but you can respond more effectively tomorrow. And ask all members to allow us to adjourn after that response until tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I actually don't have a very big response to that. The bill is drafted on a type of NINA process in mind. The framework, sorry, is drafted with a type of NINA process in mind, because that was the one process of the different countries. I mean, India was just government, but it seems that we would be focusing on private as well. So that was not a good enough example. And in the end, it appeared that NINA was the most effective example to use. So that's what the framework is based on. But whether I do a bill for this committee to pull apart, or whether this committee first decide to find all the information and then allow me to draft, that is for this committee to decide. What I'm saying today is I can give you a bill if you accept that this is what I'll put in it.
A draft bill.
And that could be something that the committee could use as a base document. It's not that I'm begging for extra work. I really appreciate that we don't want to waste each other's time. But I have often found that with either committees or all members, it kind of helps to focus the mind if you see a bill. Because in the bill, the draft bill that is presented, you end up asking questions. And those questions seem to help focus the mind a bit more on what the outcome would be. Also, it will give time for the necessary stuff that we still need to find out, where we need to ask some questions. If the committee says, yes, we want you to do a draft bill for us, you will note when it comes back that there will be suggestions to consult with certain institutions. Because we will have to still ask a lot of questions. But somewhere we need to start asking those questions. And we need to know that we need to ask those questions. Thank you.
As I requested, we would like to adjourn. We're not using this room tomorrow. I'm now stating that publicly. This is not so I'm going to ask Mr. Herman, who is struggling to find another room, and I'm in back. Please check yourselves this afternoon for the communication of a different venue. The time of the meeting tomorrow, Mr. Herman, is 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. Until when? Until 1 o'clock. Check the venue. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.